afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. For you to call in if you have questions, they can be questions about Christianity or about the Bible or about spiritual things in general, religious things in general, ethical things in general, anything that might be of interest to somebody who is considering or involved in the Christian life. And the lines are all full right now, but they won't be for the whole hour. And so let me give you a number. And as we talk to some of these calls and you hear them move along and you know there's a line open you can get through, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Now, my screen says our first caller is Andy from San Jose. I'm wondering if that might be Sandy from San Jose. Let's find out. Hello, welcome to the Narrow Path. Who am I speaking to?
You are speaking to Sandy, Steve.
I thought so. Okay, yeah, my call screen just heard you wrongly. But go ahead.
That's okay. I mumble sometimes. Hey, thanks for taking the call again. Had questions about biblical interpretation and in listening to your show and a couple other people I respect. Seems like there's some hermeneutics, I guess is the complicated word to say, biblical interpretation.
Yeah.
What I've got so far in terms of how to interpret the Bible, you know, when I'm reading it myself, is, you know, scripture versus scripture. We've talked about that. You've talked about content, you know, who is the person speaking to and what's the content of that. The other one, I don't really understand when to do this and when not, is when. How do you know when to take something literally and when to take it figuratively? I mean, sometimes it's obvious, like, you know, the mountains are, you know, dripping like wax. I'm paraphrasing it, you know. Or,
yeah.
You know.
A land flowing with milk and honey.
Right, right. Or, you know, or else Jesus said, cast us this, you know, just believe and pray and this mountain will go into the, you know, into the sea. Again, I'm paraphrasing. How do you know when to really know it's literal and to really know it's figurative? That's sort of my question of the day.
Well, there are times when you can't be entirely sure, but most of the time there's some guide. First of all, I would say a person is not going to get far afield of where they should be by taking the Bible in sort of a common sense way. I don't think that most people have been taught to take the Bible in a common sense way. That is to say, they come to the Bible as if it's full of mysteries and mystical things, and they can't see the simple things that are being said. As for example, let me give you an example, and I did this for many years myself. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, when you're make peace with your adversary when you're on the way to court with him, lest he turn you over to the officer, and the officer turn you over to the judge, and the judge turn you over to the officer, and officer turn you over to the jailer or whatever, and you'll be thrown in jail. And he says, and you won't be out until you pay your last farthing. Well, almost everyone I've ever heard just spiritualizes that, makes that a reference to going to hell or a reference to purgatory or something, depending on their theology. And yet, it's just a straightforward teaching. If somebody is taking you to court, settle with them out of court. Otherwise, assuming you're guilty, you're going to go to jail. I mean, some might say, well, that's too mundane a thing for Jesus to really talk about. Not really. He's trying to teach his disciples how to maintain good relationships and how to maintain justice in their relationships. And if somebody has something against them and can take them to court, you better not wait for it to go to court. You know, fix it voluntarily. I mean, that's a very practical teaching. But people always spiritualize that and make it something more mysterious than it really is. And a lot of times, people just don't read the Bible with a common sense frame of mind. And I think we need to. Now, when you do, you're going to recognize that lots of things are figures of speech. Like I mentioned, when God told Moses the land, the promised land, was flowing with milk and honey, neither Moses nor anyone reading it today really believes that there was, you know, geysers spewing out milk and honey on the property. You know, everyone knows that's a figure of speech. Now, sometimes it's not so obvious, and yet it can become more obvious by simply reading more of the Bible. A lot of times people don't realize when you're reading the Bible, you're reading a document that's thousands of years old, which at the very least means it was written to people in a different culture than ours, who spoke a different language than we do, and had different presuppositions. But that makes it confusing sometimes. The first time you read the Bible, you run into things that are very unfamiliar, very foreign to our culture and our way of thinking, and therefore very difficult. But the answer is not to give up on reading the Bible. The answer is to read the Bible more. It's like learning a language when you're a little child. A baby who's born into a home hears all kinds of sounds coming out of his parents' mouth, but can't make sense of any of them. They're all unfamiliar. But he doesn't just shut down to it. He observes it day in and day out. Eventually, they become familiar sounds. Eventually, they come to have meaning to him. And eventually, he's fluent in the same language his parents are fluent in. And that's how it is, I think, in understanding the Bible. Read it, meditate on it, read it more, immerse yourself in the language of the Bible, and then you'll begin to recognize common turns of a phrase, common figures of speech, and so forth. Now, if you're thinking about the hermeneutic principle of how do you know if a particular prophetic thing is to be taken literally or not, which is really the bone of contention often
right.
between dispensationalism
right.
and
right.
Reformed theology, well, the main thing I would say is you have to decide which hermeneutic is going to be better. And here's the two. You either interpret the Old Testament by the light of the New Testament, or you interpret the New Testament by the light of the Old Testament. Now, this is much more profound than what you think, and it's a profound difference in approach. The dispensationalists believe that you must interpret the New Testament in the light of the Old Testament. That means that if the New Testament doesn't say anything about, a physical throne of David on earth, if the New Testament doesn't say anything about a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem in the end times, well, the fact that people think the Old Testament says that is imported and brought in. So that as they're reading the New Testament, they're bringing in Old Testament ideas that they think they got from the Old Testament, and they import them so that you've got, you know, when Jesus says there's going to be great tribulation, someone says, well, that's going to be the 70th week of Daniel.
Right.
You know, and so they're borrowing Old Testament stuff. Now, sometimes you've got to do that, but only when it's justified. You see, what the dispensationalists actually say, you need to interpret the New Testament by the Old Testament. Now, Reformed theology takes the opposite approach, and that is that you interpret the Old Testament in light of the greater revelation that's given in the New Testament, so that the Old Testament is unclear. It was even unclear to the prophets themselves. Remember what Peter said about the Old Testament prophets. Peter in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 through 12, he said that the Old Testament prophets searched diligently to understand more about the nature of their own prophecies, and God revealed to them that it wasn't for them to understand. It was for a later generation to understand. And Peter says, we're that generation, the ones who have had the gospel preached to us. Now, we're the ones who can understand those prophecies. Now, Peter's saying that even the prophets themselves didn't understand the meaning of their prophecies. How much less did the uninspired rabbis and common people of the Jews understand them properly if the prophets themselves didn't? But the apostles did. And many times Paul says, you know, this is the secret that is hidden from generations past but has now been revealed through the Holy Spirit to the holy apostles and prophets. He says that about four times in his writings. And what the New Testament writers are saying is the Old Testament was difficult to understand, but God has clarified it through the revelation he's given through Jesus and the apostles. So Paul says in, you know, 2 Corinthians 3 that today when Jews read their own Old Testament, there's a veil over their eyes, so they can't understand it. But he says, but that veil is taken away in Christ. In other words, you add Christ and the revelation Christ brought and his apostles brought into the mix, and then the veil is taken away. You can understand what the Old Testament was about. And so I think the Reformed people are more correct in saying, well, we need to interpret the Old Testament in light of the New, because the New becomes the code breaker. The Old Testament's written in many times symbolic language, and the New Testament tells us what it means.
And then, of course, if that, Steve, that totally makes sense. And it just sort of things click when you said that. And I guess when you do read something in the New Testament that you don't fully get, you could still go back to the Old Testament and try to bring light into it. But what you're saying is there's more, for lack of a better word, more light in the New Testament in terms of understanding than there is in the Old Testament. So we use that as our backdrop first and then go back.
Let's take an example that was brought up by a caller who was dealing with a messianic believer. okay. recently. It was talking about keeping the feasts. Now, in the Old Testament, it says that the Jews were supposed to keep Passover in the springtime and follow that with 7 days of eating unleavened bread.
Right.
So you had the Feast of Unleavened Bread following Passover. Now, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, 7 and 8, he says, Christ our Passover has been sacrificed for us. Therefore, he says, let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.
Okay.
Now, Paul says, let us keep the feast. Some dispensationalists and virtually all messianics say, well, see, Paul is saying we should keep that Jewish feast. And they're basically trying to understand Paul in light of what, you know, the Old Testament instructed. And I would say rather, no, let's understand the Old Testament feast in light of what Paul said. Paul said that keeping the feast isn't a matter of avoiding physical leaven for 7 days. It's a matter of avoiding the leaven of malice and wickedness and living in a life of sincerity and truth, which he calls unleavened bread. So that Paul, in other words, gives meaning, gives us this Holy Spirit's meaning. In the Old Testament, it was obscure. In the Old Testament, it said in Deuteronomy, you shall not plow using an ox and a donkey together under the same yoke. Now, who would understand what that means until the New Testament comes along and Paul says, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers.
Right.
You know, and so the donkey is an unclean animal. The ox is a clean animal. And they represent believers and unbelievers being yoked together. And so you have this kind of stuff. In the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy, it says you shall not muzzle the ox
right.
while it's treading out the grain. Paul quotes that twice in his writings. And in 1 Corinthians 9, when he quotes it, he says, it is written, you shall not muzzle the ox that treads out the grain. And then he says, did God say this because he cared about oxen? Or was he saying it about us? And Paul gives us an understanding of it, which is spiritual. And so again and again, you find the New Testament writers will take something from the Old Testament, and instead of just taking it in its literal application,
right.
they see a spiritual meaning to it that they clarify. And so what we need is the New Testament to interpret for us the Old Testament.
So, in another verse, just as we're talking about that, it's in the Old Testament, do not boil
a kid in his mother's milk.
Yeah, and of course, the Jews believe that's the reason they keep kosher. I mean, it's milk and meat being separate, I believe.
That is why, yeah.
So what was that all about? I mean, what did that mean in the Old Testament?
Well, that's a hard one, but most commentators think that that's referring to a Canaanite custom, that they would boil baby goats in the milk of their own mother, specifically, not just because it was nice to, have boiled kid meat, in milk, but the fact that they did it in the milk of its own mother was somehow symbolic, I suppose, and somehow perverse.
Right.
I mean, not that it's morally wrong, literally, to do it, but it's somewhat perverse. Here, the mother's milk is given to sustain the child, and it's being used to boil the child. And I honestly don't know exactly what the application is, because the New Testament writers didn't tell us an application to that one. But the point is, it's repeated numbers of times in the Pentateuch. And it was apparently a Canaanite custom, and God told Israel not to do it. There probably is a spiritual reason behind it if we kind of trace Paul's thought about, muzzling oxen and so forth, we might be able to figure it out.
So one last question then I'll get off on terms of the literal versus figurative. I think it's in James where James is talking about, when you believe something, do not doubt, because if you doubt, you're like the casting of in the sea back
mm-hmm.
and forth. So I mean, when I pray, I don't believe everything. I'd love to tell you I'm 100% believer. I mean, I'm pretty close, But when I pray, I got doubts. So if I take that verse literally, I mean, that means I'll never get what I pray for. But yet, I don't know how to be 100% belief. Do you understand my question?
Yeah, I think that 100% belief is not always required, although it is always desired. God always wants us to have no doubts, but he knows our frame. He considers that we're dust, and sometimes he'll accommodate our own weakness. Remember what Jesus said when the disciples kept falling asleep and Jesus kept telling them to stay awake. He said, the spirit indeed is willing,
right.
but the flesh is weak. I think that he understands that we desire to please him in all things. We desire to have perfect faith, but he knows the flesh is weak. At the same time, I believe that we are to grow in our faith, and we do so by seeing the faithfulness of God over time and becoming more convinced that, you know, God is really there and God really does keep his promises. And, you know, when a person is a new Christian, they have to kind of base it almost entirely on what they read of those things in the Bible itself, what they read of God's faithfulness to Abraham or to David or something like that. Then of course, that builds in them confidence that God is a faithful God. And also maybe they hear the testimony of other Christians, too. But in time, our walk with God should yield a great number of our own experiences of God's faithfulness so that our faith becomes more common. I mean, when I say common, I mean it becomes more automatic that we trust God.
Steve, that was great. That just shed light on a lot of stuff for me. And how do I get you to come down and speak at our church or speak? I mean, I know you do that periodically.
I speak almost anywhere that I'm invited.
Okay. Then it's just a matter of getting an invitation and the right setting and all that.
So. It's a matter of inviting me at a time that I'm not already booked to go to be somewhere else. Yeah.
Should I do that by email? Is that the best way to do that with you?
Was that by email?
Yeah.
That can be a good way to do it, sure. Email is usually a real good thing. I'm fairly booked up in the immediate future.
Okay.
But you can look at, you know, you can't look beyond the current month on my website because it doesn't go beyond that, telling where I'm going to be. But
if I get something nailed on my side, I'll send you some emails. We'll correspond. So, Steve, thanks for all the work. Good work. Keep it going, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right, Teddy.
Take care.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Call screen, you're going to have to hang that up for me. My computer has just logged off of my assistant producer, which means I have to log it back on in order to control these calls. I know I have calls waiting, and I will be taking those calls. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we will be taking your calls here in just a moment. If my call screener wants to put on the next caller, I've almost got this rebooted. I've got a bit of a problem with it. Oh, wait. Give me one second here. Okay. See if we're getting it there. All right, we're back up and running. This sometimes happens. What happens is if I talk to a caller too long, more than 15 minutes, then this program that I have that connects me to my call screener, it just kind of folds. It just kind of goes down, and I have to reboot it and have to go through two passwords and all kinds of things while I'm talking to you, which isn't easy for me because I'm not good at multitasking. Anyway, we're back up. We're going to talk to Michael from Santa Cruz, California. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, good to hear you. What inspired me to call today was a while back, maybe a month ago or so, a Christian friend sent me a book called something about Jesus meets Buddha. It's written by an East Indian fellow, a Christian who...
Ravi Zacharias?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it the Lotus and the Cross?
Did he only write one book with that theme?
He might have written more. The one I have read and the one that I'm familiar with, I think it's called The Lotus and the Cross, and it's called Jesus Dialogues with Buddha, or Buddha Dialogues with Jesus, or something like that.
Yeah, I might have forgotten the title, but yeah.
Did you read it?
Definitely a dialogue, and they were something about a boat.
Yes, they're riding in a boat together.
Yeah.
The picture is that Jesus and Buddha and a third party, I think a woman, is riding in a boat, and they are talking about her and her situation.
Yeah, the woman, yeah. I think this, you know,
her sufferings.
Right, she was in dire straits. Anyway, I read this a while back, and then I passed it along to my friend who's interested in both Buddhism and Christianity. And I have to say, you know, very frankly, I was quite discombobulated because it was not a fair portrayal of the Buddha. It was a typical, very superficial, very almost cartoonish rendition of the Buddha.
You know, Michael, when I read it, I thought about you. And I thought, well, I'd like to pass this by a real Buddhist and see what they think about it. So I'm glad to get your feedback on it.
Yeah, I'm not somebody who gets irritated particularly easy, but I found myself just almost wanting to throw the book out the window because it just wasn't fair. I have no problem with someone espousing the, you know, their faith in the Christian path and, you know, making the case as you do very eloquently every day for Christianity. I have no beef with that. What was upsetting to me, though, was he was representing the Buddha or representing his teaching in ways that just are not true.
I actually listened to it on an audio book as someone reading it as I was driving on a trip to L.A., I think a few months ago. But I was thinking it's a very risky thing, both to represent what Buddha would say and what Jesus would say in certain cases. Obviously, Ravi Zacharias is a Christian, and he's from India, but I don't think he's ever been a Buddhist or a Hindu either. I think he's always been a Christian, or at least I'm not sure about that.
He mentioned that he had Hindu. He grew up in a Hindu culture. He was very familiar with it. Maybe he still has friends or mm-hmm. colleagues or whatever. And he had the basic outline. It started out like he was familiar and he was informed. But then as the dialogue progressed and it got into more like differences of doctrine and just the different views, then he really started.
Well, Michael, let's cut to the chase. Why don't you share with us what you think would be a truer representation than what Ravi Zacharias gave of say, the Buddha's position?
Well,
Can you think of a core flaw, or was it flawed?
Yeah. No, that's just where I was going. I mean, it's so common in the West, not just from the Christian perspective, but from the general, just the people who read about, like, say, Nirvana or the Buddhist notion of emptiness, to equate that with nothingness, that people hear about Nirvana and they think it's extinction, that the one's existence is just blotted out.
I always thought it was absorption.
It's not exact. That wouldn't really be.
What would be a better word for it? Is there a better word in English for us?
Yeah, it would be the disillusion in the literal sense of that term, that one sees reality clearly and as it is, rather than it being distorted through perceptual or habitual.
But does the person retain his individuality?
Well, from the Buddhist understanding, the individuality, in the sense of the ordinary...
Is that one of the illusions? Is that one of the illusions?
Yeah, the ordinary sense of existing as an individual is the core illusion that is seen through. But that doesn't mean that one's existence ceases. Rather, the way in which the mind was perceiving it changes. Mm-hmm. So the old metaphor that's used quite a bit in the East, of the snake and the rope, that one is habitually seeing a harmless rope as a snake. And when one sees that snake is actually not a snake but a rope, that's analogous to seeing, you know, reality more clearly. And then one is freed from the fear.
Let me jump in here, Michael, not because I want to cut you short, but my lines are full, so I'd like to see if we can get some like some bottom line issues here on this. Now, I'm not an expert on Buddhism. I've never claimed to be. You are a Buddhist and a fairly expert one, it seems to me, from my talks with you in the past. So what would you do you want to talk about the book per se, or are you more interested, let's say, in just clarifying what true Buddhism teaches or whatever?
Well, no, that wasn't actually the main theme of my call today, but I did want to mention that. I would just say that, just to sum up that point, that what's his Zachariah, what was his name?
Rabbi Zacharias.
Uh-huh. Rabbi Zacharias. That his understanding of the Buddhist teaching was incomplete. To say
well, that's probably true. I mean, he's a Christian apologist, all right.
Yeah.
So I'm a Christian also, and I've read books about Buddhism, trying to understand it, but. You know, I don't think you really understand any religious faith until you kind of get inside of it. I mean, you can kind of see what its general pattern is before you get inside of it. But people are continually, representing Christianity a certain way to me, people who are not Christians. And I can tell right off that, you know, one of their problems is they're not Christians. They don't understand it from inside. They understand it from outside. And more properly, they misunderstand it from the outside. And I'm sure that we who are Christians have a tendency to do the same thing with Buddhism, except perhaps in the case of people who were Buddhists and became Christians, and there are plenty of those. But and someday we're hoping you'll be one of those, Michael.
Well, you know,
Then you can write a better book on this.
I don't know. Did you ever read that Thich Nhat Hanh book that I gave you, which was it was from the Buddhist point of view, and he was attempting to find the commonalities. It was a much more general.
Mm-hmm. I have not managed to read it, not because I'm not interested. It's still on my shelf. I just have had other things that were pressing. There's always a lot of things pressing for me to read.
Yeah, I know you have a lot of calls today, but I wanted to throw one more thing at you.
Okay.
And that is, you know, in Christianity, actually this dovetails well into the previous caller. He was saying that he doesn't always feel that his belief is 100%. You know, from the Buddhist perspective, you know, one is never told that one has to believe anything, or rather, everything is left open, and then maybe one can begin to know some things, you know, in one's heart, intuitively or, you know, directly. But I wanted to ask you, you know, isn't there somewhere in I forget which book, but either Jesus or one of the apostles is saying, you know, if you haven't seen, and you believe, that's better. Like,
yeah. He said to Thomas, "You believe because you have seen. Blessed are those who, having not seen, yet believe."
What would be the virtue in sort of having a blind faith? That I find hard to see.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a good question, because I don't think that God commends gullibility.
Yeah.
And I think if somebody believes something for no reason, then they're just gullible. And I don't think he's recommending that people are to be considered blessed because they believe for no reason. But he was saying there's going to be a lot of generations of people who will not have the advantage of having seen Jesus. And blessed are they if they believe anyway. Now, why would they believe? Not for no reason, but because of the credibility of the witnesses. See, that's the thing. Thomas had doubted because he had not been present when Jesus appeared to the other disciples. Thomas had been absent. And so when the other disciples told him that they'd seen Jesus, he said, "I won't believe it until I see it with my eyes and touch him with my hands and so forth." And so when Jesus appeared to him, said, "Well, now you believe because you see, but blessed is he who, having not seen, believes." I don't think he's saying, "Shame on you that you didn't believe your fellow apostles, but you sure missed out on a blessing. I mean, you've spent 8 days," which was the interim between those two appearances, "you spent 8 days, you know, perplexed and confused and bereaved of Jesus, where the other disciples have been rejoicing in the truth. And there's a blessing to be had for those who can accept the testimony, if it's credible testimony. So that's the issue here.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because, you know, in the early Buddhism, which is known as Theravada in the Way of the Elders, it was much more about the meditation, about the actual mindfulness, okay, and, you know, gaining insight into the nature of the mind and the nature of experience.
Yeah.
It was, in a way, you could say it was more psychological than philosophical or religious.
Yeah, it wasn't strictly religious, right?
And then it was in a certain sense, but not in the sense of as it's understood in the West.
Yeah.
Then, as Buddhism evolved and went to different places, the Buddha became seen as more like a deity or
mm-hmm.
a savior, and people would supplicate and pray
right
to the Buddha. So it's an interesting.
Michael, I always enjoy talking with you.
And I know today you're.
Well, one thing, the format of a program like this just isn't conducive to study everything about a major religion of the world, even Christianity.
Right.
But I know we'll have future talks.
All right.
And as we have had in the past. And I appreciate your comment. But is there one final thing you just want to get across before I take my next caller? Because I don't want to just cut you off rudely.
Getting back to that book, you know, like I'm sure if have you met this guy?
No, I haven't met Rabbi Zacharias. I'm familiar with some of his other works. But is your concern would be that if any Christians read it, that they should know that it's not necessarily, an in-depth or even maybe, in your opinion, accurate portrayal of the Buddhist thought. Is that right?
Yeah, it just wasn't fair. It was not a fair representation of his teaching.
Well, you know, another thing, Michael, I think Rabbi Zacharias would probably appreciate you getting in touch with him, writing him or something, and telling him what you thought were the weaknesses of the presentation. Because even though he may have not presented Buddha as accurately as a Buddhist, like yourself, would wish, I think he probably wished he could. I don't think he deliberately, did it incorrectly. So if he's missing out on some depths of the teaching, I think he would actually appreciate you contacting him.
Well, I wouldn't know where to begin because it's at a core level. I mean, he would really have to it would take a long dialogue just to explain.
Okay. Well, we don't have time for a much long dialogue now.
Right, right.
Because I have calls waiting. I'm going to run out of time.
All right, Steve. Well, good. By the way, I saw Jim, our friend who would come to the meetings on the bus the other day. I hadn't seen him in several years. So.
I'm glad he's still alive. He's had a lot of problems in his health.
Yeah.
All right. Well, God bless you, Michael.
All right, Steve. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Interestingly, Michael, who we were just talking to, and Sandy, the caller before him. What I find interesting and almost ironic is that both of them are born of Jewish extraction. They're both Jewish by ethnicity, but neither of them is Jew by religion. Sandy's a Jew who's become a Christian, and Michael is a Jew who became a Buddhist. And actually, Jewish people becoming Buddhists is a very common thing. In fact, a Jewish Christian, or maybe it was a Jewish Buddhist, I'm not sure, told me that they actually have a name for it called a Jubu. This is not a joke, that they call them the Jubu if they're a Jew who became Buddhist. And I guess there's a very large number of them. Michael has been a Buddhist for many, many years, and we've been in dialogue for many years too. But we need to talk to some of the other people, including two callers in a row from Las Vegas, Nevada. If you'd like to be on, we might be able to get to your call too if you want to give me a call, you can call me at 1-800-438-5090. We'll talk to Abel first from Las Vegas. Hello, Abel.
Hi, Steve.
Thanks for waiting so long.
No problem. Hopefully I can make it quick myself. And if maybe you can answer some questions or give me some advice on divorce and remarriage. This is for my personal situation. I've been divorced almost 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And, sorry, I'm still a little coming from a cold, so I'm with my voice a little off here.
Okay.
but we were married about 6 years, and during the first year or two of our marriage, I became aware of the doctrine of the remarriage and the biblical teaching of not divorcing a married person and all that, because my ex-wife was divorced. And when I met her, she was divorced.
Before we go further, let me just see if I get this clear. You've been married only once, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and but the woman you married had been divorced from a previous marriage?
Yes.
And now you and she are divorced, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, but when you first got married, you didn't know much about the teaching on the subject of the Bible.
That's correct.
But you've studied it since then. Go ahead.
Yes. And since I study it, it always bothered me, you know, in my heart and my conviction.
Well, I may be able to help out. I mean, lots of people have the same concerns you do. Let me ask you a few questions first, yes. though. I mean, you might be planning to tell me, but I know which things I need to find out if I'm going to give some kind of an answer.
Yes.
How did her first marriage end?
She was actually married before that.
She'd been married numerous times.
Yes, so I'm considered the third.
Okay.
As far as I know, the third. The first one, she was married to. It was short. I guess she was divorced because he was a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't a Christian or anything at that time, and it was through the courts, whatever. So what I understood, and then years later, she married her second husband, I don't know. I don't know too much about the situation, but I think he had some mental issues. He was abusive. I think he was immoral with her as well. My understanding, they were
okay. So he has been immoral. Both of her husbands have. Did she divorce them, or did they divorce her?
She divorced both of them.
Okay, and the first one was a Muslim. Why did she divorce him?
I think because his father was not pleased with her because she wasn't of the same faith, and she wasn't in the same, I think, country.
Okay. So why didn't he divorce her then?
I really don't know.
Okay. Go on. What have either of her husbands done since her divorce from them? Have they gone on and remarried?
No. I don't know anything about the first one. She hasn't mm-hmm. seen him in many, many years. But the second one, unfortunately, he passed away. When her and I were dating, it was like 4 months into the relationship.
Okay.
He passed away. They were divorced at this point. He passed away a few months later.
So you're wondering at this point if your marriage to her was legitimate?
Yes. And.
But now you're divorced from her.
Yes.
Could I ask you, I'm sorry to jump in so much, but I've got little time and lots of people waiting. I just thought it takes a long time to hear all the details of someone's marriage and divorce.
Yeah.
But I, in order to give you any counsel, there's some things I specifically would have to consider. Why are you and she divorced now? What happened there? In a nutshell, did she divorce you?
Yeah, she divorced me.
Okay. And why did she divorce you?
Well, she didn't, because we weren't compatible, according to her. You know, we didn't get along. There were kids involved, not my kids, or
uh-huh.
her kids. And we had a lot of disagreements. But there
so
was
our,
no one, but I, we were not unfaithful to each other, at least,
right.
you know, and that I was aware from her
is
point of view.
Is she a believer?
Yeah, we both met it. We both met at church at the Christ, the intern, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now, are you wondering whether you have the right to remarry?
Yes.
Okay. One other thing. How you've been divorced, what, a couple of years?
It'll be 2 years in June.
And what has she done? Has she dated other men?
Well, that's, yeah, I was just going to get to that.
Okay.
If I may. Yeah, this is the thing. When we were officially divorced, she moved to Texas. And yeah, we were keeping in contact, you know, out of friendship, supposedly, right? Like, And not long after that, she seen a guy there. So, really shortly after the marriage. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any reason to believe they've slept together?
Now they're back here in town. And,
oh, they live together. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't like to hurry these things along, but I mean, obviously, if this were to be an actual counseling session, it would take an hour or more just to get everything out, and we can't really do that. If you're wondering about the biblical teaching as I would understand it, and I put it that way because there are Christians who hold different views than I do on divorce and remarriage.
Right, right.
My view is fairly, is pretty much the standard view among evangelicals, although there's different views as well. My understanding is that you would be free to remarry, primarily because she has moved in with somebody else. She is committing adultery. I don't believe she had grounds to divorce you. Now, whether your marriage to her in the first place was legitimate, that's very complex. We don't know much about her first marriage. But it becomes irrelevant at this point.
Right.
Because whether your marriage to her was legitimate or not, she divorced you without grounds, and now she's committing adultery. So you have the right to be free from that marriage, it seems to me. The Bible does indicate that a divorce on the grounds of adultery is a legitimate divorce. And although she divorced you, you know, that's a technicality. I mean, she divorced you, but God didn't recognize that divorce because she had no grounds. The state gave her a divorce, but the state isn't God. God says you're still married. But the point here is that she is in adultery now, and she doesn't want you. And so you're free to be divorced. Now, you don't have to go and get a divorce. She's already taken care of that legal part. But you are, I believe, free inside of God.
Yes.
If you want a longer treatment of this by myself, I have a written article, two articles that are put together on that were published in a magazine years ago, and they're at my website. If you go to thenarrowpath.com, there's a link there that says topical articles, and one of them is called Divorce and Remarriage. And if you look at that, it goes through all those scriptures. And I'm very sympathetic with you, and it may not seem like it because I'm moving along here like this, but if we were in a counseling session and not on the air, I'd be glad to talk much more at length with you. But the bottom line is I believe you're free.
Okay. All right. Good.
I appreciate you calling, Abel. I'm sorry that you've had this tragedy, though.
Okay.
Being free doesn't make it not hurt.
That's true.
All right, brother.
Thank you so much for giving me that advice.
All right, brother. Yeah, if you read my article, you'll get a lot more of my thoughts about every circumstance in there.
I will. Thank you.
Okay, bye, Abel.
Bye.
All right, I'm going to take a call from Brian in Las Vegas. Hope we'll get to Phil in Edmonds, Washington. And before I do either, I just need to say, speaking of Washington, a week from today, we pay our radio bills. We do this once a month to stay on the air. And Washington is, Seattle is a new area for us. And we have a donor. He's not in the Washington area. He's actually in California, listens on a different station. But he has offered to match gifts that anyone sends that are designated to pay for our Seattle airtime. Now, if you live in Washington or you live anywhere else and you want to help us pay for our Seattle airtime, this brother will match gifts up to $1,000. He did the same thing last month, and that's one reason we're able to go on in Seattle. And so anyone who wants to send gifts additional to what you maybe already send, that is, we don't want fewer gifts to our other stations because then we can't pay for them. But if anyone wants to donate specifically to the Seattle station, all gifts combined up to the first $1,000 will be matched by this brother. So that'll double the value. We have to pay that bill in about a week. And I'll just tell you right now, we don't have the money. In fact, right now, we're not even close. We don't know what will come in the next week. But if you would like to help to pay for the expenses of our being on KCIS in Seattle, there is this one donor. As I say, he's not even a Seattle listener, but he cares about the Seattle station. He's enthusiastic about us being there. He will match gifts up to $1,000. So I just thought I'd say that. If you want to donate, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. We're going to talk to some more callers, but if you want that address and didn't get it, you can go to our website. You can even donate by PayPal if you want to. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk to Brian, who's been waiting for almost a half hour. Hi, Brian. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I had something to listen to. you get a lot of calls, of course, about and a lot of other apology shows get calls about people asking if they can lose their salvation it pretty much being determined, you know, yes, through apostasy, you know, if you completely hang it up and want to have nothing more to do with it. And sometimes people ask about backsliding and comparing it to that, but the thing that seems not to get touched on very much with any show I listen to is the lukewarm factor. And because that seems like a way you can lose your salvation without outwardly apostatizing or not.
Jesus said that the church that was lukewarm, he would vomit it out of his mouth.
Right.
Which at least means that that church would cease to exist as a church in Christ. I'm not sure in applying that to individuals, how we would do that, because, almost everyone would feel themselves to be somewhat lukewarm. That is, all of us know that we could be more zealous than we are. And if we said, well, you can lose your salvation by being lukewarm, well, then everyone would have reason to be questioning their salvation, I suppose, because I don't preach like Jonathan Edwards, you know. I don't pray 2 hours every morning or 4 hours every morning like John Wesley, you know. And you know, we could all begin to call ourselves lukewarm by comparison to others. I think that the main thing is that we should be pressing into Jesus as much as we know how, as much as we can, as much as God gives us the grace to do, and. There will be times when we might even mistake ourselves for being lukewarm when we're not. Because what we're doing is we're trying, as we're putting out desiring entirely to be loyal to Jesus, but, you know, the emotional stuff that we might use as the barometer of whether we're lukewarm or not, our emotions may not be kicking in. You know, emotions can confuse us, and especially if we have very little emotion. We might think we don't have much love for God. But really, our love for God is seen, I think, in our determination to please Him. And when you're determined to please Him, what is that but love? I mean, it says in 1 John chapter 5, verse 1, that this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome. Well, God's commandments are burdensome to someone who doesn't love Him. If you love Him, keeping His commandments is not burdensome. Because you like to please Him. You want to, and you're determined to. So I do think that when people lose their love for God, then there's a good chance that they're drifting from God altogether. And if they drift from God completely, I do believe that their salvation is in jeopardy, is in doubt. But I'd be very cautious about saying to someone, if you're lukewarm, you've lost your salvation, because... Well, I don't know if we're really often a good judge of whether we're lukewarm or not, because we're always looking for indicators like in our emotions. Am I still as excited about Jesus as I was when I first got saved? Well, are you still as excited about your wife as you were on your honeymoon? Maybe, but maybe not. But the question is not, do you have the same excitement about your wife, but are you as faithful and as committed and as desiring to please her as you were on your honeymoon? The emotions may or may not be the same, but the emotions are not what God's reading, I think.
Okay. Why would He, and He said He'd rather you be cold or hot. Why would He rather than be cold?
Well, some people say, some people would understand cold to mean unbelieving altogether, and hot to be, totally committed and totally believing, and that lukewarm is somewhere compromised in between. That probably is how we'd understand it, though we have to say that Revelation doesn't really explain the metaphor of lukewarmness, but that's kind of the way we would figure it. We'd figure, well, that must mean that being cold means you're turned off completely to God. Maybe you're just a pagan. And being hot means you're totally on fire for God, and then lukewarm is kind of undecided in between. If that's what it means, I would think what Jesus is saying is, I'd rather you weren't even calling yourself a Christian if you're not going to love me.
Okay.
You know, I'd rather you were just a pagan. Not that I want anyone to be a pagan, but if you're going to be like a pagan, I'd rather you called yourself a pagan rather than, call yourself a Christian and be in the church and have the world looking on you as an example of what it means to be a Christian. And really what they're seeing is the example of being a non-Christian. but they think that's a Christian. And so that gives Jesus a bad name. I think that's probably why it'd be better to be cold than lukewarm.
That makes sense. One quick other question, a little off topic. Have you ever heard of the author Brennan Manning?
I have heard of Brennan Manning. I've never read his work.
Okay.
Okay. God bless you.
All right. God bless you. Thanks.
Good talking to you. All right. I wanted to get Phil in here, too, who's calling from Edmonds, Washington. Sorry you had to wait so long, Phil, but some waited longer. Hi. Welcome.
Hello. I've got a couple questions for you.
Okay.
I'm in discussions with a friend of mine who is deeply rooted in Calvinism.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to tell you right up front, I don't really follow that theory.
Nor do I.
I've been investigating a little bit, and I've found some disturbing things about Calvin. And I'm wondering if you've ever read or nowhere else I could substantiate some of the things that he did.
Like
when
the burning of Michael Servetus?
I don't have the book with me right now, so I just heard you on the radio, and I'm calling you. So I'm not 100% prepared, but when people were opposing him at different times in his ministry, he basically eliminated them and had them burned at the.
Yeah, he is known to have done so, at least in the case of Michael Servetus. Michael Servetus was a guy who had been, he was a heretic, but I don't believe in burning heretics. You know, Michael Servetus had been branded by the Catholic Church as a heretic. Of course, Calvin would have been branded by the Catholic Church as a heretic, too. But Servetus didn't believe in the Trinity, and so Calvin thought he was a heretic, too. Calvin actually sent a copy of his own works to Michael Servetus when Michael Servetus was in prison.
That's the one, yes, that's the guy.
Yeah. Okay. Michael Servetus marked up the copy with negative reviews, sent it back to Calvin, and Calvin wrote a letter to a friend saying, if Michael Servetus ever comes to Geneva, he won't leave alive.
Okay,
well, unfortunately, Michael Servetus did come to Geneva, and he didn't leave alive. Calvin had him burned at the stake. And that's a very dark blot on Calvin. Now, Calvinists try to, mitigate that, but it's still a dark blot on Calvin.
Well, how can I find more? What I'm trying to figure out is how can I substantiate how Calvin's doctrines are actually false and how that is influenced the church in a dramatic way more than we realize. Is there more works I can find about this?
I'll tell you what, there's lots and lots of works, but one that you can find right at our website for free is a series of lectures I gave called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. If you go to our website and click on the link that says Topical Lectures,
okay.
I go to a nine-lecture series on Calvinism. It's called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. And our website is thenarrowpath.com. I'd like to answer your questions more here right now, but the music that's playing says we've only got a few seconds.
I will do some investigating and give you a call back.
Okay, great, Phil. Thanks for your call.
Thank you for your time. God bless you.
You too. Bye now. Yeah, our website is thenarrowpath.com. And if you're interested in the Calvinism issue or any other issue, I've taught on them. I guarantee you. We've got about 1,200 of my lectures at the website. No, 900 at my website. There's about 300 at another website. But it taught on just about everything. And if you go to the website and click on the link that says Topical Lectures, you'll find, as I say, series on almost every subject under the sun, including one of them on Calvinism. And that one is called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. There's many others, too. TheNarrowPath.com. Appreciate you joining us today. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday. We're a listener-supported ministry. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air where you're listening to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. The website, again, is thenarrowpath.com. I'll be seeing some of you tonight at Twin Lakes Church in Aptos and this Saturday in Orange County. Information is there at the website. God bless you. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.